Happy Friday. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. Our team today, Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel and contributor to Bloomberg View. Hey, Joni.
Good morning.
Luke Burbank hosts the TBTL podcast and Public Radio's Live Wire, so you'll hear him later tonight. He's going to catch a shower and a change of clothes and be back tonight at 8. Lucas.
Hello, Bill.
Good to see you.
When did you get up today?
I made the scene at 3 in the morning. You? Same?
About 20 minutes ago.
Lives diverging. C.R. Douglas, political analyst at Q13 Fox News. C.R., welcome.
Good morning.
And a big hello to Steve Scher, who I imagine is in his pajamas right now.
He has been so active on social media this week,
yeah,
which is a very 2014 thing to say, but I will say that Steve has been tweeting and making podcasts and as invigorated as I've seen the guy in a long time. So
in his pajamas.
Yeah, all in his pajamas. That's the secret to podcasting.
In case you haven't heard, Steve decided that being a local journalistic lion for 28 years was about right. And if he was going to talk about another book, it was going to be his. So he's his own man now. And I've never lived the writer's life. I don't know. I imagine if I had a novel that I had to finish, I would be watching Italy and Costa Rica right now.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
I would have memorized the entire Croatian side. But the
we're
writer's
talking
life.
About the procrastination
yes,
that
ma'am.
Comes with the writer's life. But he's going to get to it. And that's exciting, don't you think?
Yes, I do. Steve, enjoy. We love you. We miss you. But the news never stops. So let's go.
I got
that noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
For 15 years, I've been trying to teach you how to write a lead. Do I have to do everything myself? Get the story? Write the story?
Listen, saphead, I could blow a better story out of my nose than you can write.
All right, here's the lead. It was a good week for mustache rides. Is that appropriate?
It works.
Well,
it works.
See,
it totally works.
You know the cars with the facial hair on them?
I thought you meant the novelty T-shirt I bought at Seaside, Oregon when I was a kid. Mustache rides 5 cents.
Yeah.
I mean, it's worth something.
You overpaid.
You know how you need a ride? So it used to be you'd call a taxi company and you would talk to a dispatcher who hates you and you don't dare offend him or complain in any way when your cab is late. You won't call back because then he just might not send it at all. Well, you don't have to put up with that anymore. You can pull up a smartphone app and you can book your ride and see exactly where the car is and your driver's photo and name. And it's pretty convenient, but pretty unregulated. And taxi companies complain that that lack of regulation in Seattle disadvantages them. And the city council agreed they capped the number of rideshare drivers that could be on the road at any one time. The rideshare companies fought back. This is Ubers and Lyfts and such. And they put a ballot measure up to repeal those new rules. And this week, the mayor, Ed Murray, stepped in and CR, he brokered a new deal.
He did broker a deal. He did what he did on minimum wage so effectively, which was get a bunch of people in the same room who effectively have been at war with each other and cajoled, pushed, pressured, flattered, did what he, you know, learned to do in Olympia and got them to agree. So these three stakeholders, really taxi drivers, the four hire drivers and the rideshare people ended up at a press conference with him shaking hands, a kumbaya moment. It's amazing how quickly he was able to change the war narrative to a peace narrative, and it's something the council tried for a year and a half to do and couldn't, and he walked in, and it's two for two now. Did it with minimum wage, did it with this. It's an impressive record.
Can I be sort of a wet blanket on that just for 1 second here? And that is the difference between the announcement on the minimum wage and on the rideshare. There were a majority of council members at the minimum wage event, and this just featured mostly, as I understand it, the rideshare folks. There may be a few ruffled feathers at city council because they had worked on this for so long. And then it's sort of like the mayor had to come in and do this part of it. And so they were a little tentative, if you don't mind my saying so, about the deal. Seems like they'll probably go for it because it's one of those harmonic convergences that actually works. And if you mess with it, it'll totally mess it up. But there's some bruised feelings down there.
I think they're slightly bruised feelings, but listen, this is the deal they had hoped to strike and couldn't.
Why couldn't they?
Well, it was a tough war, And they didn't have, as nine people, a very good sort of single voice. So when you're kind of one person as the mayor, it's easier. I think secondly, and we should give them credit for sort of bringing the parties along a significant amount of the way, but why couldn't they clinch the deal? Well, in a way, it took them passing a law that clarified everything very quickly. Up until their law, things were kind of abstract. So
yeah,
they sort of had a law. There were clear winners and losers. It was easier for the mayor to walk in.
They set him up.
Say, they did set him up. They did set him up. I think that did help.
I think this is just a technology story, really, because the technology that Uber and Sidecar and Lyft use is so clearly superior in terms of getting a ride worked out. I mean, yeah, you talked about it, Bill, in your intro. This calling up the dispatch. I mean, you're late for the airport. You yeah, call the dispatch. They're like, "Yellow cab." And then it's like 80 people yelling in the background. And then like the car's not coming an hour later. And you go, "Yellow cab." You call, "It's on the way." And it's like,
you're in your car driving.
It's the most disorienting and powerless feeling. Yes. And the idea that you on your phone, and I should say full disclosure that the podcast I do, one of our sponsors is Uber.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just because we were so over the moon for Uber that they finally said, "Well, if you're going to talk about us, we might as well give you guys some free rides." So my enthusiasm for Uber is independent of that.
Do they go to Port Townsend is the question.
It's about $800. But Joni, it is riding in style, my friend. No, but the ability to look on your phone and see where the car is that's coming to get you and know how far away it is. And let me give you a perfect example. Yesterday, I took an Uber from the east side. I was over doing some stuff for Microsoft. And I came over to Seattle to the single room occupancy hotel where KUOW picked me up last night.
Nothing but the finest.
And I left my phone in the Uber car, which I have done many times in taxi cabs, and it's just like, you know,
you write that off.
You pretty much you have to, you know, release desire,
yes,
on that phone. I went into the hotel room. I got the laptop up, and it just – I went to the website and said, "Did you leave something in the car?" And I clicked on it, and it just gives me the phone number of the guy who I was just in the car with, because it's all very carefully tracked.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him, and he said, "Oh, yeah, I'm still two blocks away." He circled back and gave me the phone. That ability with the technology is so much better than what goes on with cabs that it was just a matter of time. And really, the cabs are just turning into Ubers now.
Okay, we have about a minute to devote to what actually the deal was. Like, what's changed that I care about if I ride these services?
Well, the deal the mayor struck was that there'll be no limits on the number of rideshare drivers out there. The council,
is that a big deal?
It is a big deal. I mean, the rideshare companies say on a given Friday, Saturday night, they have, you know, they can have 1,000 drivers out there. And if you're limiting each company to 150, and basically there are only three companies, it does make a difference. So they get an unlimited number of drivers. They wanted that. The four higher folks, the flat rate car folks, they wanted the ability to get hails. They wanted to be able to sort of be like taxis. And
yeah, you can't just call it for hire.
You can't just flag a for hire.
Right.
You have to call. This allows them to pick up flags. That was a huge part of the deal for them. And finally, taxis hate being so regulated, and there are less regulations for them in this new deal. They have lower insurance requirements. There are no longer dress codes. And
they have an app now. They will be allowed to work more or less like...
You know, what's the difference between a taxi company with an app and a rideshare service?
Well, you know, in Washington, D.C., they both work off of apps, and a single phone call could get you a taxi or an Uber.
So why do I care anymore?
Well...
Is it all the same?
I'm glad you said that at the end of the segment.
Why do I care about the last 7 minutes?
Well, because the transportation options are larger than they ever will have been because of this deal. And Luke is right that they are going to look more like Uber. I mean, Uber is going to look a little bit more like cabs. There are more regulations. There are more insurance requirements on the rideshare in this deal, but also cabs are – there is a new app that cabs have that is going to be, for all intents and purposes, like the Uber apps where you can just look and call a cab up.
Okay, we're out of time. We got an email, which I encourage, by the way, from Lauren, who says, "Is there a glimmer of hope that these recent traffic congestion incidents will push our state legislators to pass a transportation bill?" Since we're talking about getting around. And Lauren, I have good news for you. We're going to talk about that in – about half an hour. This is KUOW's Week in Review. Mm-hmm. We're still talking about taxis. You want to defend taxis?
Well, I want to defend them a bit. I mean, clearly Luke Burbank's had a horrible experience, but
I don't have any problem with taxis as far as once you're in the car riding around. It's the getting the car to you.
And
that's
I'll defend the dispatch. I mean, I've taken a lot of cabs in the last 10 years, and I would say my experience has been almost uniformly good. Yes, there have been some times where I've called and it's taken a little bit longer, but I'm all in favor of the new rideshare, but I've had great experiences in taxis. They've carried a lot of people around this region for a long time.
In fairness, Yellow Cab sponsors CR's podcast.
Right. You know what, though? You joke. I know, Bill, we need to move on, but yeah. If you ever get in a cab in this town, you will hear KULW.
Oh,
absolutely.
So we got to be careful what side our bread is buttered on.
Oh, yeah,
here.
Because the East Africans and the Eastern Europeans and all, they live for the news.
Shout out to Mesfin.
Yes. Yes, thank you for saying that. Seattle City Light, next topic. Seattle City Light was planting puff pieces about itself online. The Seattle Times reports City Light executives didn't like what was rising to the top of Google search results about their utility and their CEO, so they hired an online reputation management company to drown out critical stories in the search results and replace them with happier items. Here's the pitch from Brand.com president Mike Zamuto.
We have an expression around the office, you are who Google says you are. Because Google is so important in so many decisions, you've really got to take seriously what's shown up there. And that's actually our first tip. Take seriously your online reputation. Google yourself regularly. Search for yourself and see what comes up. And then proactively start building a persona online that matches what you want it to be.
So this plan came about, Joni Balter, because of a Seattle Times public disclosure request. And
yeah,
now we know.
That was really quite a piece there that Jim Bruner did, because what he did, he was just reading the contracts, some of the contracts that go out, and found a fairly interesting contract that produced a rough week, shall we say, for City Light. And this contract was for up to $47,000 to write sort of happy stories about City Light and the CEO, Jorge Carrasco, that would talk about how green the utility is, supposedly America's greenest utility, and he's the green expert and all of this, because he didn't like some of the things that were coming up on that Google search. You know when you're going to meet somebody, they always say, okay, I'll Google you.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like what was coming up. Now, the downside of this is the week that the city council was approving a significant raise for him. There were boos in the chamber when this happened.
There was boos in the chamber?
Not that kind of boos. Boos, like I'm booing something you're saying.
Oh.
And, that's very impolite and sort of un-Seattle. But, the income disparity, it has legs in this city, that whole issue. It does. And so people are like, so this guy's out there, his utility is out there spending up to $47,000 to get him a better Google search, and we might pay probably $60,000 more for his salary. Ick.
Okay, well, as far as the Google search thing, a lot of government agencies use PR firms. Luke Burbank, what's the problem?
I don't like this argument that we have to sort of burnish the image of Seattle City Light, because then we will be able to attract this top talent, because it's kind of like, where does it end? Like, we have to have fire poles in the office, because if we have that kind of, and free Slurpee machines, because then we'll be able to
attract
get
top talent.
The best talent, and then we'll have the most efficiently run, city power grid. I'm also wondering, they're kind of, trying to manage his image and City Light's image. Who's the competition? Like a paddle wheel in your backyard? You have to use City Light, right? If you live in the city of Seattle, so
we're gonna lose him to big hamster.
Exactly.
If we're not careful,
like you're gonna Google his name and then go, he's terrible. I'm building a solar array.
Right.
It's like you're probably gonna use City Light, so it seems even more pointless for them to spend this money.
I mean, part of the frustration is that City Light, like any other organization, public and private, they want good press. They want people to write great stories about them, and they were having trouble getting that. And there's a reason they're having trouble getting that, because the story they want to tell, they're the greenest utility, they have great conservation, it is a very old story. It was 2005 when they became the first utility to be carbon neutral. That's a 10-year-old story. That has been told. The conservation programs, they have been going on for 30 years. So there's a lot of stuff that's happened there. But if you want to get another story in the press on our newscast and someone's paper on the podcast, give us something new, City Light, or else just don't worry about being the press. They need something else if they want these articles.
Well, the way I think of this is once you're the highest paid, say, city employee, it's similar to the state. And we went through this with former University of Washington president Mark Emmert when he was the highest paid state official.
Right.
There was all this noise about
he made like he was almost a $1 million.
Almost a million. And you'll note that the current UW president did not want to deal with that, so he came in at a lower rate. Now, it's lower. All of this is relative, or relatives, as I always say. But, in this case, as soon as you're the highest paid anything, there is going to be the classic Northwest, discomfort with that and discussion of it. And that Jorge Carrasco, now if you Google him, this is the story.
Right.
I'm not sure it worked.
Because of this company that they hired and these pieces that were written in places like the Huffington Post, where they cite Jorge as this green lighting expert, and then nobody mentions that the guy who wrote the piece in the Huffington Post actually worked for brand.com.
Thanks, Huffington Post. Yeah. Well, the Ethics Commission, Seattle Ethics Commission, said that they had no problem with this. So maybe that's it. We're not used to this. It seems weird, but this is apparently common, right? And we just all will learn not to read trust everything we read in the Huffington
Post.
Well,
listen, all the city departments have big PR units. The biggest of all is City Light. I mean, they have always been the
richest.
That's
like gravity having a PR unit.
Because they're
just happening, and you have no choice in the matter.
They're over a $1 billion operation. I can tell you they have all kinds of money to throw at the media unit. So it's a little bit it's not surprising that this is sort of being pitched and they're trying to burnish images. It's a little bit surprising that they need to go outside and contract, given how many people they have in-house to do this.
We need to take us a break. Yes, Joni?
I was just going to say, it's just modern-day PR that has verged into this sort of phony thing where you write these stories that, we don't recognize to be real stories.
How'd you like to do PR for the Washington Redskins right now? We're going to get into that here in a few minutes. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review with Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail, Seattle Channel, Bloomberg View contributor, C.R. Douglas at Q13 Fox News, political analyst, Luke Burbank, TBTL, and LiveWire, and we're all with you reviewing the week, and we'll get right back to it on KUOW.
And I thought you were the moon in the sky, but it turned out you were just a street light. You were burning like a hole in the night. You were burning like a city of electric light. You were burning like a city of electric light. You were burning like a city of electric light. You were burning like a city of electric light.
KUOW's Week in Review with Luke, C.R., Joni, and me, Bill Radke. So the Redskins are on the ropes, if you don't mind my putting it that way, even. This week, the U.S. Patent Office found that name of Washington, D.C.'s NFL pro football team. They found that name is disparaging to Native Americans and not worthy of federal trademark rights. And then around here, the Seattle Times announced it has stopped printing the team's name. Sports editor there, Don Shelton, said, "Far from honoring Native Americans, the term colors an entire race. Many Native Americans consider it an outdated label placed on their people." Luke Burbank, is that sensitive or oversensitive?
I think it's exactly the right decision on the part of the Seattle Times. I mean, there are so many words that we've retired from the lexicon that are racially tinged that it would be ridiculous to use in the sports section or any other section of a newspaper. And I think that the R word, as it's now being called, is just the latest one that we've finally started to identify, I think, on a larger scale. I mean, really, the walls are closing in around Daniel Snyder and the football team from Washington, D.C., because this case with the U.S. Patent Office was years in the making. And of course, they can appeal it, which they're going to, and they can continue to use this mascot and this logo, but it's no longer protected federally as a trademark. So it means anybody else can make their own knockoffs of the football teams. I'm working,
which
really
is lucrative because that name is hot right now. Everybody wants to get in on that.
I want to read you though. This was the argument that was put forward by the Washington football team's lawyers to try to defend the use of this word. The word red appears in a large number of terms in English. It should be noted that there is another meaning for redskin, descriptive of a variety of potato. In the case of the potato, it is because of its color. In the case of the people living in North America upon the arrival of the Europeans, it was likewise based upon appearance. And this was their argument. When we trademarked this name, it wasn't racist. But more recently, this has become a pejorative way to describe Native Americans. So our trademark should be legit, because when we got the trademark, it wasn't racist.
Racism should be grandfathered in.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to imagine the October 6th showdown between the Seattle Seahawks and the Washington football team. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to imagine what the announcer says when he's trying to call all these plays, because it's going to be awkward. What if you have an announcer that agrees with the patent office and is trying to call this darn thing? And it's going to be, they need a new name.
What side of history? I'm just speaking to the thousands of sportscasters who listen to this show every week.
Yeah.
What side of history do you want to be on? I feel like it's not unlike gay marriage. It's not unlike marijuana decriminalization. It's like, do you want to be the last person standing in front of the doors of the school saying, like,
okay,
no integration?
CR, I want to hear from you, but I want to set you up, because maybe I'm a slight voice of dissent, which is that the name is obnoxious and insulting and should go away. Obvious. Well, I don't know if it's obvious, but I think so. It's not obvious to everybody. But I, as a Seattle Times reader, I feel a little patronized that I'm not allowed to even read the word and make up my own mind. So. Any feel it differently, CR?
Well, and actually listening to Joni, I'm kind of interested in what Fox is going to do, because we play the Seahawks games, and when they play the Redskins, I don't know what we'll do.
Well, everybody knows that the football robot is a racist. I mean, that's a given.
I think it was the right decision by the Seattle Times, and I do think it's only a matter of time before the squeeze is too tight, as Luke says. I mean, the trademark decision has a financial implication. And what's going to eventually change this, I think, is finance. I mean, if they lose that, it's not just that the Redskins stand to lose if they sort of lose that trademark and lose the ability to kind of, you know, sell under that. There is revenue sharing on merchandising. So every other football team benefits by every other football team's merchandising and loses when merchandisings go down for a team. So suddenly we have a conversation now and a stakeholder group that's larger than just the owner of the Washington team. And you have Congress getting involved here. I mean, more and more members of Congress are signing letters. I mean, they can mess with your life. They can mess with your TV rights. They can mess with your antitrust rights. I mean, the league is starting to get scared about what this means for all owners.
Yes, so I understand that Bill was being Bill because he, you know, just to kind of push the issue.
No, the maybe, Seattle Times had
I
a
like po- that's called listen, being Bill now.
The Seattle Times had a policy starting
way.
For years. The Times has just printed the name one time factually and then dropped it because you don't need it after that. And I just thought that was the right policy. Say with the name, but it's just a fact. A word is not offensive. The context is offensive. And just to say who's playing the Seahawks doesn't, you know, offend me, even though I agree about the sentiment.
Well, there's a little bit of grandstanding in there, but if you ask them, and I did, I wrote a note to Don Shelton, who I know very well from working there all this time. So what's the difference, and where is the next line? What about the Kansas City Chiefs? What about the Cleveland Indians? And he said that he felt that Redskins rises to a different level of racism.
Absolutely.
And if you talk to Native Americans, they will tell you that they consider this just to be so offensive.
Except for the ones at Wilpinjong High School in Spokane on the reservation, where their name is still the R word, which the Seattle Times also is not going to print. And people there say, don't you dare try to change our high school's name. So there is a divergence of opinion.
And they also said they will do it in stories about the controversy. They will mention the name.
I would consider that in the category of rappers being allowed to use the N-word.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
that's
quite
fair.
Seriously. It's just you get to do it if you're the person, if you're part of the group of people that is affected by it.
Good point. KOW's Week in Review, right back after this. K KUOW's Week in Review. Good morning, or whatever time it is. Topeka, because we have listeners all over the globe. I'm Bill Radke with Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, contributor to Bloomberg View. Luke Burbank, TBTL, the podcast, Live Wire, the radio show tonight at 8 on KUOW. C.R. Douglas, political analyst at Q13 Fox News. America's favorite DJ, Kamal Amin Kassem, died this week in Gig Harbor. You know this son of Lebanese immigrants is Casey Kasem. His radio show, American Top 40, ran from 1970 to 1988. Every Sunday evening, I would listen until dinner time. And when I had to leave, I would set my yellow Panasonic cassette recorder next to the radio and tape it so that later I could lie in bed and listen back to the entire countdown, along with the vacuum cleaner and the dog barking and whatever other audio was recorded in the background. It's such a distinct memory to me. And one of the features of his show was the long-distance dedication, where he would read a letter from a listener. That started when Kasem was a DJ in San Francisco in 1964, and he read this letter from a teenage Beatles fan about what happened to her right after a concert. I'm going to play a little piece of it because I want you to hear how Casey Kasem delivers this letter.
Something caught my eye. I looked up and saw George and Paul walking together, behind them Ringo and John. George and Paul were talking with a couple of guards and laughing. They didn't see me. Before I knew what was happening, I was running to George. I caught him and I hugged him. Boy, I sure did cling. He was taken by surprise, and when he realized what was happening, he smiled at me and said, "Hi, Bert." The tears were running down my cheeks, and I clung hard, but couldn't say a word.
I think most 1960s DJs would have read that letter like, "Local Fab Four fan meets the Mop Tops." But he's reading that almost like he's this girl's father or something. Like he remembers feeling that way about somebody. And I think there was, you know, that, I think he brought a little humanity to what he did.
I grew up listening secretly because I grew up in a household where I wasn't allowed to listen to non-Christian music.
That's so right.
On Sunday morning, I would listen to American Top 40 furtively in my room before we went to church. And that long-distance dedication really made an impact on me too, Bill, because a thing about it that by the time I got into the 80s, it had turned into a lot of these letters from regular people. And
right.
What I loved about it was, you know, it was always kind of the same setup. It'd be like, "Dear Casey, I had a love and lost them."
Yes.
You know, he was everything to me. But the thing that was great was that the song they would request would never have anything to do with the circumstances of this. It'd be like, "He lives now only in my memories. Could you please play Pour Some Sugar on Me?"
Yes. He was the original Delilah.
Yeah. Yes, he was.
You know, before she came up. Sort of Dick Clark meets Delilah was Casey Kasem. I, too, listened. I wouldn't say I was doing quite as much listening as you two. Maybe that's the radio guys in you that got some success. But I did listen to a lot. I mean, he was a distinctive voice of all our childhoods. I can still listen to him, and I find I do. I got satellite radio a couple years ago in my car.
And they play Casey Kasem's Top 40?
You can go to like the 70s station, and you can listen on Sundays to the Top 40 of that week of 73, 74, whatever.
KUOW just lost half its listeners. I'm disturbed.
And you hear him saying, "And the number one song this week," and, you know, it's Hall & Oates or something. And I find I'm actually fascinated by re-listening to
Casey. I would pay to hear that the number one song this week is Driver's Seat by Sniffing the Tears, you know, like, oh my God.
But, you know, I mean, in reading some of his obituaries in the past weeks, he was a pretty conservative guy, not politically, but in terms of what he wanted to talk about on his show, like in 1987, because his whole thing was, we just read the songs in the order that the American people have essentially selected.
Right.
So he wasn't making any judgment calls. And one of the songs on the list in 1987 was I Want Your Sex by George Michael.
George Michael.
And he would not say that, because he felt it was inappropriate. So in a not unlike the Washington football team sort of thing, he said, you know, "And here's the latest from George Michael."
Uh-huh.
That was his way of getting around saying, "I want," and then playing a song where the guy sings, "I want your sex" like 300 times.
because you could disagree with right. what the list was, but you never hated Casey Kasem,
right.
even though he delivered the list.
But that's what I liked about him. You're acting like he didn't do everything in the classic radio voice, but he had a killer radio voice, if you think about it. And whenever you'd hear it, it would be like, okay, the world is all right. Whatever was going, whatever was changing. But there was like this bookend to the week that here he is. You know, the world is natural. This guy has given me 40 songs, whether I like him or not, and whether he hates him or not.
Listen, I have to say, by the way, why we're talking about this here is that he, part of the reason he spent his final days on the Kitsap Peninsula, his wife brought him to Silverdale, your boyhood home, Luke, and there was this sort of this sad family fight over, you know, between his kids from his first wife and his you know, his second wife of 30-something years, by the way.
It was a very ugly reality show at the end, and really quite a circus and sad. One thing that struck me about him, though, is given how kind of quintessentially America he was in his kind of style, and he was incredibly fringe in his politics. I mean, he was quite leftist. I mean, he was anti-nuke activist. He slept with the homeless in L.A. to sort of, you know, advertise their plight. He supported Jesse Jackson for president. Later, he supported Ralph Nader in 2000. Then he supported more recently Dennis Kucinich. I mean, this guy was
a string of winners.
This was a very fringe guy politically, for as vanilla as he was as a radio personality.
But you know what was left out, or at least not given enough treatment in most of the obits, or even here today, guys? He was the voice of Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, but
Shaggy,
you know what?
Excuse me, Shaggy.
Yeah. He was the voice of Shaggy. But wasn't that just like the voice of Casey Kasem doing Shaggy?
No, so weird. That was like being a total out there stoner.
Who talked like that?
Casey Kasem, yes. Being the voice of Shaggy.
Exactly.
That had a huge impact on my childhood. I'm the age where that show was like, you know, you never missed that show.
Thank you, Casey, for the music and for Shaggy and for the long distance dedication.
One thing that I'll always remember is the way George said, "Hi, Bird." It was so romantic, and he was so handsome. Well, Casey, thanks for reading this. Elena.
And I think Casey would want me to say now that the number one song in America today, he's a former Mouseketeer, a happily married man. He's accused of appropriating African-American music. This is Justin Timberlake's Not a Bad Thing.
I said all I want from you is to see you tomorrow. And every tomorrow, maybe you're letting me borrow your heart. Is it too much to ask for every Sunday? While we're at it, throwing every other day to start. I know people make promises all the time.
KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Luke Burbank, Joni Balter, and C.R. Douglas. This week, Seattle police have, I've found out anyway just this week, that police have an internal split, a debate going on over the department's PR effort to talk like the people do. You know that in 2012, SPD hired a former cops reporter at The Stranger to be in their media relations department. Jonah Spangenthal Lee immediately brought the department national attention for its new tone. When marijuana was legalized, he wrote a very informative Q&A called "Mero What Now?" And it was factual information, but it was also written in plain English and slang. Question, legalization seems like a really long ways away. What happens if I get caught with marijuana before then? Answer, hold your breath. Your case will be processed under current state law. Question, what happens if I get pulled over and I'm sober, but an officer or his canine buddy smells the ounce of super skunk I've got in my trunk? This was from the SPD. So a question this brings up for me, I'd like to hear from you guys, but should police, do you think police should ever try to be funny? That's kind of the debate.
Well, I have to say that when the Seattle Police Department last year came out with its Doritos handout for Hemp Fest,
right,
and you realize, you know, legalized marijuana is coming and people have all the questions that you're reading. And so I thought that was really clever. And it was so sort of unlike Seattle PD to hand out these little baggies of Doritos with like a single piece of information across it. Like, oh my gosh, the police department has a sense of humor. I thought that was a good thing, especially as we were legalizing marijuana. But who knew that it was internally politically just causing all this trouble? That was revealed in the Amy Radel story on KUOW. Mm-hmm. She did quite a good job there.
I think whether SPD should be funny on Twitter and these kinds of things represent a larger the larger issue we've all been talking about with the Seattle Police Department, which is the old way of doing things and a new way of doing things. And you have this kind of divide that we've seen in the media unit. You have this divide, in effect, in the rank and file about, you know, who's sort of ready to be the new generation police force versus who's kind of kicking and screaming. I mean, you have just a week or so ago, rank and file officers filing suit against their own department, against the Justice Department, not liking some of the new reforms, especially this new use of force policy. I mean, they don't, you know, they don't like the new way of doing things. And I think this resistance is showing up in all kinds of ways in this police department. I mean, it's a battle that's not over.
A huge number of the incidents that have happened with the Seattle Police Department that have made the news have been because of escalation of things that usually didn't have to be escalated. I don't mean just on the police department's part or the police officer's part. I mean, you have a citizen who's doing something, you have a police officer who's saying, stop doing that, whether it's a kid crossing the street near Franklin High or something I witnessed in my neighborhood down in Mount Baker a few years ago where a guy was trying to cross Rainier and the cops roughed him up. These situations that get escalated are to some degree because of lack of communication between both parties. And if the police department can figure out ways to relate to the public in a more, in my opinion, normal way, I think it lowers the chances of those situations getting escalated.
I think it's a reality now that we, you know, Twitter is changing the way everybody communicates, everybody who's using it. And so there was an issue a few weeks ago with how SDOT had some tweet that aggravated motorists.
Yeah.
And here you have the Seattle Police Department and many public agencies saying, well, if we're going to communicate in 140 characters, does it all have to be so boring? Could some of it just be just like the way normal people talk, which is what Twitter does to the language?
Again, I may be alone on this one. Does it raise any hairs on the back of your neck when, because of the power dynamic? Like, part of humor is naughtiness, and I don't like to think of my police department as being mischievous. If, you know what I mean? Like, what else do they think is
if
funny?
You were observe,
that's exaggerated, but it's just, I don't know. I kind of like the Joe Friday humorless cop.
If you observe the best Seattle cops, the ones who have beats and they know the people in the neighborhoods that they work, I bet you anything, if you were to be a fly in their car riding along and walking to them, I bet you they use humor.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
no,
you know what I mean? I'm talking about with the public. I'm saying a police officer who shows up somewhere and is able to talk to somebody in a normal way and diffuse things.
Yeah.
Somebody who's in Belltown, where my SRO is, and they're walking the beat.
You got to get off that SRO.
I can't. You know what I mean? If you'd seen what I saw. I don't know if that's grammatically correct. I think humor is part of law enforcement, and I think using it at Hempfest is as good a place as any.
And humor is disarming. It's a way that people all get together because they had a good laugh together. And I agree with that.
I hate humor. This is KOW's Week in Review, where we review the week. And we just got this tweet at KOW. Good luck, Bill. Have fun. I sip a second cup of coffee with all of you from guess who?
Ah.
Jonas Spangenthal-Lee.
No.
Steve Scherr.
Amen, Steve.
We'll be right back. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Joni Balter, C.R. Douglas, and Luke Burbank. And we have developing news, I would say breaking news, and that's why our education reporter, Ann Dornfeld, just walked in. Hi, Ann.
How's it going?
I'm good. Tell me about this. Seattle Public School Superintendent Jose Bonda has just announced that he is a finalist for Superintendent of the Sacramento City Unified School District. Bonda has only been at the helm in Seattle for 2 years, has 2 years remaining on his contract. And so, Ann, will you tell us what this potential changing of the guard means?
Yeah, he says that he wants to return to his home state of California and, are you ready for this, spend more time with his family there. He spent most of his career in California before he became soup in Seattle. And he says he'd also like to return to the generous California retirement system in time to finish his career. But of course, it hasn't been a walk in the park leading the school district in Seattle over the past couple of years, along with the standard board friction with the superintendent. There was also things like that giant teacher boycott you may remember of the district's standardized MAP test last year, and that got national attention and, of course, not the kind that a superintendent is looking for, and some other conflicts. Not he hasn't been a hugely controversial superintendent, but, you know, it's not all roses in Seattle. There are a lot of people who have a lot of opinions about how a district should be run, and they're not afraid to talk about it.
And this is not the first time this has happened, right? Hasn't the Seattle School District had a lot of churn lately?
Yeah. When he became superintendent, he was the fourth superintendent in less than 2 years. We had a few interim superintendents between the last permanent superintendent, who, as you may recall, got fired after she was found to have let north of $1 million leave the district via the pockets of one of the district officials who's now in jail. Mm-hmm. The district has a lot of involved parent and community groups, even in good times, that have really strong feelings about the direction the district should go. They're going to weigh in and perhaps slow superintendent's initiatives, make it tricky for a superintendent to get what they want done, perhaps, unless it aligns with what some of these groups want. And they have very different agendas.
Does Bonda have any reason to believe the job will be any easier in Sacramento?
Well, if their superintendent hiring process in Sacramento is any indication, I would say that it may be easier for him there. In Seattle, when we're hiring a superintendent, the finalists are announced pretty early in the search process. They fly into Seattle. They do public forums. They meet with the media. It's a very public process. In Sacramento, by contrast, the board had not announced its finalists at all until they were scheduled to vote on Bonda's contract last night on the consent agenda and still didn't announce the finalists last night. So if the Seattle process did not appeal to Bonda, it sounds like the Sacramento process is the polar opposite. But the Sacramento board decided the last minute to postpone the vote until they do a visit to Seattle next week.
KOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld, I'm not going to force you to respond to any opinions from our guests because you're just bringing us the facts, so thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Any chance the NBA will step in and keep Seattle superintendent from going to Sacramento?
No, but think about it. Seattle and Sacramento, we have this thing, don't we? So we want to swap out basketball teams. The last time we did a Seattle police chief search, the top candidate was from Sacramento. And now you have a wandering superintendent from school superintendent from Seattle headed that way. So we got a thing with those folks, you know.
It's going to be pretty ugly if he doesn't get the job. Yeah. And stays here. That's called lame duck.
This is the problem with being a city the size of Seattle, is that you're at this level where people who are on the way up or on the way down seem to sort of stop in, you know.
Right.
Because if they're on the way up, there's something bigger going on. If they're on the way down, you can't get rid of them. You got to hire a PR firm to zhuzh up their Google image.
On the way down, this is KUOW's Week in Review. We'll be back in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Joni Balter, C.R. Douglas, and Luke Burbank. And by the way, we will have much more discussion to come about potential changes in the Seattle School District. News and analysis on that. Stay tuned for it. Right now, we're wrapping up a few other stories that broke through this week, one of which is, this has been the story of the last few weeks. If you commute through Seattle by car, you have had the chance to listen to KUOW. More than usual lately, as you stare at the bumper in front of you. We had an expansion joint cover pop up on I-5. There was the giant traffic jam featuring a collision and a Mariners game, and then there was the guy who stopped on the freeway and set his pickup on fire. The bigger problem, though, is not that weird stuff. It's the normal congestion. The traffic data company INRIX says congestion was up 7% in 2013. Luke, did traffic help drive you away from Seattle to Port Townsend?
You know, it didn't, but once I got to Port Townsend, where I now live, my wife and I talk all the time about how much traffic was negatively impacting our life, and we didn't realize it. It makes me think of when my daughter was finally potty trained. And one day I was just like, I haven't changed a diaper for like 2 weeks. that was horrible when I was doing it. You know, and now I drive around Port Townsend and I listen to the traffic reports in Seattle. This is a real thing. And I take a perverse pleasure in not being in the traffic.
Mm.
Total Schadenfreude.
That hurts.
You.
Or no, the reverse, whatever that is. Happy in Freud, because I work in Port Townsend where there's no traffic.
Well, you know, population growth comes with that actually as part of it. And that there's somebody was quoted in one of the stories as saying that our streets, and you don't need somebody to tell you this, that our streets are at capacity. A friend of mine said, have you noticed stop signs? How many cars are in front of you at every stop sign? That it's just growth. And don't forget, in the summer, everybody comes here to visit, and so streets are even more crowded than normal.
Well, we got Sierra, respond to this, if you will, but we got a comment on our Facebook page, which, by the way, KUOW Public Radio. Paul says, who cares about driving anyway? I moved to Seattle to not use a car.
Well, it's not that easy. Mm. Theoretically, it will get easier, and if you could say that there's some hope, it is that light rail is going to open to UW in 2016 and then go beyond, that these rideshare services, you know, will maybe explode, that streetcars are about to sort of, you know, come online in other parts of town, that you have better bike lanes. I mean, there are some alternatives that will do some things, but they're not great. I mean, if you don't want a car in Seattle, it still is pretty tough. The problem is that there's no margin for error. So when you get like a joint pulled up on I-5 or whatever, and I happen to be stuck in that traffic jam.
You know, or a sunny day when you can see Mount Rainier.
You know,
any excuse for a traffic jam.
With the marijuana legalization, you've got to be careful when you say when you pull a joint on I-5.
Good point.
Just but like clarify. If you take like 520, if you take the Viaduct, some of these older freeways, there are no shoulders. So when you get a stall, one lane's dead. When you get an accident, often two lanes dead, and then you lost that entire capacity until they can get it changed. Now, one thing that's going to benefit, I mean, building new roads does help. A new 520 will have shoulders. You'll be able to sort of move those stalls off. A new viaduct tunnel is actually going to have shoulders. So there are some things we're going to do that's going to help, but it's the result of more people in the same amount of space.
The light rail is going to be a big deal because that is the biggest congestion point is Northgate to Union. And so that really will make a difference, but that's a ways off as well.
That's new, by the way. That segment of from Northgate to Union just overtook I-405 through Bellevue, according to this company. But this traffic data company said that Seattle drivers wasted 38 hours sitting in traffic last year. How do they know that we wasted that time?
Some of us were texting.
Hello.
So we were able to make use of it.
It's called KUOW. We talk about it like it's, you know, you if you're stuck in your car, you can
listen to Casey Kasem. 40s, which
you
is
can call
I
your
do.
Mother.
I can call my buddy in Los Angeles. I can make plans. I can have some solitude and a daydream. I mean, isn't gridlock apocalypse or whatever a little bit over?
But see, that takes a level of planning that I'm incapable of, because what that means, Bill, is you were going to somewhere that used to take 15, 20 minutes.
Exactly.
But you left
in 1974.
Yeah, you now leave yourself an hour and a half.
Yes.
And then you're just kind of in this little bubble of enjoyment as you wend your way to the place. I'm always still trying to make it there in 15 minutes.
Right.
And I'm going crazy.
Because it worked one time.
Yeah,
but that's how much time.
I hit a wormhole.
But that speaks to a real change in this city, is that whatever number you had before, I don't know, is it 40% different? My work commute had changed by 40%. So I think everybody's experiencing that.
But I think you're onto something. I mean, the fact that there is not outright revolt, that there's not – I mean, people are doing something in these cars as they sit for what seems irrationally long periods of time. They are texting. They are phoning. It doesn't feel like totally wasted time. If it did, you would have pitchforks in the street. Somehow people are actually living with all this traffic. Mm-hmm.
KUOW's Week in Review, it doesn't feel like totally wasted time. And we'll be back in a moment. Luke Burbank hosts TBTL and Livewire. How do you do it?
Just lower the bar
for the
quality of broadcasting, and you can do a lot of shows, Bill.
C.R. Douglas, political analyst, Q13 Fox News. Jody Balter, civic cocktail on the Seattle Channel and a contributor to Bloomberg View. And we're not done with the week's news yet. So baby, don't make a move because I'm coming for you. KUOW's Week in Review. Hi, I'm Bill Radke. This week, KUOW performed and recorded the official song of the city of Seattle. And as far as we know, it's the first time this song has been performed since 1909, when a man named Arthur O. Dillon wrote the lyrics, presented them to the city council, which told him, Arthur, if you want the song approved, you have to sing it right here in front of us. And he did. That song, of course, was Pants on the Ground, and the city council was in hysterics. Really, though, more than a century later, KUOW reporter Deb Wong discovered the lyrics while researching the city charter. There was no sheet music, so KUOW editor Phyllis Fletcher found an entry for the music at Seattle Public Library. Librarian Tracy Wolf dug up the original pages, sent them to us, and I give you the theme city that's called Seattle, the Peerless City, 1909.
Seattle sits on seven hills. Her glory is unfurled. At her feet is Puget Sound, where moves the commerce of the world. Her bosom's gemmed with pearly lakes. The mountains tower near. The fir tree forest skirts her.
KUOW would like to apologize for the lyrics, her bosom's gemmed with pearly lakes. Sweet, that's not appropriate. How about that? So that is the song of Seattle. Did you even know it existed?
I did not, but it's actually still up to date.
It still works.
It still works.
She has to work some traffic jams in there, but she'll be good.
Actually, it's the opposite of up to date, because it's about seven hills of Seattle, and like three of them have been graded long ago.
But the waterfront's still a hub of commerce.
True. True.
It's still got a little ways to go before it eclipses Baby Got Back, in my mind, as the official song of this town.
Luke Burbank, what's on Livewire tonight?
We have the guy Daniel Handler, who is the Lemony Snicket author, the Series of Unfortunate Events books. We talked to him about how he met his wife in college, which included having a seizure in a class with her and falling on top of her and then love blooming.
That is the oldest trick in the book.
I know. I'm not even sure if it was medically caused or not, but that's what we're going to talk about tonight.
That sounds great. Can you make 8 o'clock come faster for that?
Yeah, Bill, you go take a nap, which you need anyway, and it'll be right around the corner.
Does it show? Luke Burbank, TBTL on LiveWire, C.R. Douglas, Q13, Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
KUOW's Week in Review. Send us an email, weekinreviewkuow.org. Keep in touch with us all week on KUOW's Twitter and Facebook pages, which are escaping me. Does anyone remember those? KUOW, I'm new to this. KUOW Public Radio, right? On Facebook. Thank you, Bernard. Okay. Thanks for joining us. Let's do it again in a week. Absolutely. Thanks, everybody.
See you then.
Yeah.
The bluest skies you've ever seen are in Seattle. And the hills, the greenest green in Seattle. Like a beautiful child growing up free and wild. Full of hopes and full of fears. Full of laughter, full of tears. Full of dreams to last the years.